This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Saul Barenthal came to the U.S. as a teenager. He arrived with little more than a few boxes of Cuban cigars. He grew up in Cuba, but he and his family left the country after the revolution in 1960. This was not the first time Saul's parents pulled up roots and moved to another country. They had both fled Eastern Europe during the Holocaust. Saul made the adjustment to life in America, worked for IBM for many years, then started his own software company. But he's never forgotten his native country. And today, Saul co-owns a business that plans to bring tractors to small farms in Cuba, and it will be the first U.S. factory in Cuba since the 1960 embargo. Saul Barenthal joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about your parents' travels first and how they got to Cuba. Tell us that story.
Well, it was during the Second World War, the Holocaust, being of Jewish tradition, they had to leave. My father came from Romania, and most of his family made it into Cuba. My mom's family from Poland, only her brother, one uncle, and herself made it to Cuba. They were a little bit slower in being able to bring their rest of the family, so the her parents and the other five siblings perished in the Holocaust, so she was not as lucky. The reason why they went to Cuba was because they wanted to come to the States, but in those days there were quotas. Not everybody that wanted to come could, but there was a place for people who wanted to wait, and in many of the Caribbean and Central South American countries, a bunch of Jewish communities were set up. Cuba was one of those places. My parents met in Cuba, got married in Cuba, established themselves in Cuba, and once they did, there was a reason for them to stay and not to have to migrate to the States. My mom's brother did. He did migrate, and he lived in Indiana for many years until he died about 15, 20 years ago.
You were born there?
I was born and raised in Cuba, yes.
You lived there till you were 16 or so, right?
That's correct.
So what was that like? What was it like for a Jewish community in Cuba in those days?
Well, Jewish community in Cuba was a very nice, interesting community, much like in many of the other countries. There was about 20,000 of us in Cuba, number one. Most of them merchants, I would say middle to upper middle class, even though it was a very close-knit community. We interchanged and lived with the rest of the Cuban population. There was never any anti-Semitism to speak about. Jews did not get involved in politics, but they did do contribute a little bit to the beginning of socialism in Cuba. Many of the Jews from Europe did come with the ideas of socialism and communism. The first Communist Party in Cuba was formed by some Jews. So, were not accepted, but they always stayed underground.
Were there prohibitions? Could Jews become members of the party in Cuba? You said there wasn't anti-Semitism on the ground, but I wonder politically or structurally if it was built in.
Not really. Jews in Cuba were merchants. They contributed to society. They contributed to the economy. There were too small, too few to make any impact one way or the other, so they primarily were ignored.
You were the beneficiary of public education. You benefited by that. How was your education? How would you describe it?
Well, in my times, Cuban education system was not what it is today. It was public education, which was not very good, and then there was private education. I went to Jewish schools for primary school, and then I went to military academy for my secondary. My parents thought that it would be a good place for me to be instructed in the discipline of life. My brother, on the other hand, immigrated as a student to the U.S. It was very typical for a family of means to send their kids to the U.S. to study. I chose to stay in Cuba, so they put me in military school.
Why is that? Why did you want to stay?
Well, I didn't want to go through the changes. I didn't want to go through what I had learned from my brother's experience And I gave my parents a choice. I would become a good student and very well disciplined if they sent me to military school.
Went to military school, and then you're becoming of age. You are in what we would consider high school, and in 1960, of course, the Cuban Revolution. Tell us about your parents' decision then. What was the thought process? What was the discussion like? Because it didn't happen all at once. I mean, clearly this was a possibility, and I'm just wondering what the discussion is like within the Jewish community about the potential change, and then once it happened, you know, what to do next.
Well, it's interesting to go back to those times, because I remember having, not argument, discussions with my father about what was happening in Cuba. And I was of the impression that Fidel Castro had come to Cuba to save us from the tyranny of the dictatorship of Batista. My father, having had a little bit more experience with such things, told me, I don't think so. The way he talks about things sounds a little bit socialistic. I don't think that there will be a future for merchants like us. His words were prophetic. There's no question about it. The interesting aspect of it is that even though Castro came in January 1st, 1959, which is when Batista fled, what he did at the beginning was try to establish relations with the U.S. He came over here. He spent time. But he started at the high level to take over foreign interests, the banks, the big food processors. Many of the U.S. investments in Cuba were taken over. The country saw those as good steps, because it would allow Cuba to develop their own. But then the next set of confiscations of businesses were against the big Cuban companies. And that started to create a little bit of uncertainty within the population. And pretty soon they started going to the middle class type of businesses, which affected pretty much my parents, as well as the rest of the Cuban Jewish community. Most of them made arrangements to come to the U.S. The first thing my father did was, you're going to study in the U.S. now. So we got a visa for me to come study to the U.S., and I was sent here.
Was that a difficult decision? I mean, it clearly, from your discussions with your father, it seemed inevitable. They would more or less have to leave. So it felt as though he may have been resigned to it, but that doesn't mean it was easy.
No, it was a little bit more like, this is going to be temporary. Most of the people who left Cuba in those days said, okay, so it'll take a few months. The U.S. will do something about it. Things will settle down. So we'll go out for a few months, and then we'll all come back. Needless to say, that did not happen, although there was an attempt, the Bay of Pigs invasion. I remember being in the States and listening to all the news and all the events that were going on, and you couldn't buy suitcases because all the Cubans had taken all the suitcases available. They were all preparing to go back. Right. So I was in Miami in those days, and everybody was excited. Everybody was prepared to come back, but we all know what happened.
Right.
It didn't work out.
Well, and again, you described the progress of the communist takeover. First, it was throwing out the multinational, mostly Americans. I think not a great number of Cuban people were benefiting by those investments necessarily. There was a lot of wealth being generated, but I don't know how much of it was getting down to the average Cuban. And maybe they didn't, as you suggest, shed a tear when they saw those companies leave.
Well, the Cuban population, one thing that I remember from those days, was very much an Americanized population, mainly in Havana. Not talking about the rest of the country, but Havana was a big city, comparable to New York, comparable to L.A. Miami was a small town in those days compared to Havana. So because of tourism and because of the American investments and because of the American special treatment of the sugar production of Cuba, money was flowing. People were in very good economical shape in those days.
What was it like for you as a 16-year-old boy who spoke Spanish? Did you speak any English?
Very little.
All right. So yeah. Now you find yourself in the United States. What was that like?
Well, it was hard, but two things that I thought were very important in my future was, number one, not only learn the language and get an education, but get out of Miami. If we were going to stay in Miami, we were always going to be in an environment that was not conducive to becoming an American. So to me, it was very important as soon as I could to become Americanized.
We'll find out how that happened and how it is that Saul Barenthal plans to return to his native company to build the first U.S. factory there since 1960. Saul Barenthal co-owns a business called Kleber LLC, and it's going to make tractors for small farms in Cuba. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Saul Barenthal today. Co-owns a business that plans to bring tractors to small farms in Cuba. It'll be the first U.S. factory in Cuba since the 1960 embargo. So you come to the United States. You don't speak much English. You're living in Miami. And I understand you decide you don't have much money either, but you've got a few boxes of Cuban cigars. Tell us how that helped you make the transition.
Well, that was the beginning of being able to have some cash in your pocket so that you could start setting up and doing some things by yourself. But surely enough, not only did I go and get myself into school, but I also find myself a couple of jobs. I was a bag boy for a while in the supermarket. That was good because I interacted with people, learned a little bit of the language. I call that being in the retail industry. I also got into the advertising industry because I was delivering pamphlets to people's houses. But my highest achievement was when I got into the newspaper business. I was delivering newspapers for a living. I worked myself up to about 300 newspapers every day.
That's pretty good.
So
that's
pretty good. Not a bad deal. But it was at night, of course, and after I finished with my route, I would then go home, shower, and go to school.
You came on a student visa. You came before your parents did, right?
Yes, I did. They came about 7-8 months after I did. It was kind of like the plan first to get me out as a student and then for them to come and visit me while I was in school.
I mean, that must have been particularly difficult without any kind of support network on your own and you and your 300
papers.
Well,
I was one of many, yeah. As a matter of fact, in Miami. I remember people who were in the newspaper business with me delivering papers were doctors and lawyers, people who could not practice their trade and therefore had to make a living somehow. And I kind of felt pretty proud about the fact that those people were willing to make a living in whatever it took, while they're also going to school and trying to revalidate their ability to practice in the States.
You know, you characterized it earlier, Miami's kind of a small town back then. What was your reception? What was the reception of these Cuban emigres by the local natives?
Well, I think it was pretty good in terms of the general population. The Jewish community was not as understanding about the Jewish Cubans coming into Miami at that time. There was a lot of resistance. It was kind of like, who are these people and are they really Jewish and all that kind of stuff. So the Jewish community in Miami, what we call the Juban community, set themselves up by themselves. They did set up their own congregation and they put together their own community and they put together their own services and they kind of existed parallel to the American Jewish community.
Has that changed much?
That has changed. Yeah. That completely changed once the Cubans got established in Miami and showed that they were civilized and they were real Jews and they really were part of the international Jewish communities, that all disappeared. But at the beginning, there was a little bit of friction.
Now, talk about meeting your wife. You actually knew your wife in Cuba.
My wife used to live about a block from where I used to live. So we pretty much grew up together in the community, in the Jewish community. We knew each other. We're very good friends. Her and her parents migrated to the U.S. a few months before I did. So once we met back in Miami, we kind of became a couple.
And you went to New York after that, right?
Well, her family and her moved to New York, and that gave me the impetus to say, this is my time. I'm going to New York.
Now, that's another big adjustment, right?
The big city.
Yeah.
Yes. Not only that, but the snow, the cold.
Mm-hmm.
I remember driving my car to New York. I had bought myself a car in Miami, but even though it had air conditioning, it did not have a heater.
Oh, dear.
My first winter in New York was not very nice.
You went to Long Island University, studied physics and math.
Correct. I graduated physics and math. Luckily, at the time, computers were becoming of age. Mm. And I had the fortune of being able to finish school and right away landed a job with IBM.
Did you stay in New York? Where was your first job with them?
I stayed in New York, even though I had a couple of offers to go and work in Fishkill and Endicott, which were the other manufacturing facilities. I had the ability to get a job in New York City in the retail office of IBM. IBM in those days was pretty much organized by industry. So being of Jewish heritage, I thought retail would be a place for me to go.
It also was the very beginning days of the computer industry. I mean, talk about some of the things you saw. The idea of actually sort of manufacturing memory by hand. Describe that for us.
Well, those were the days where IBM was first coming with what was then known as the 360 line of computers. The 360 line of computers was revolutionary because it was the first computer built for business as opposed to major educational
research,
or
yeah,
government research. And they bet the farm on it. IBM made a big investment on it. They hired a lot of people just like me to learn about that line of computers. And they wanted to make sure that we all knew exactly what they were all about. So they took us on plant tours to actually see how those things were being manufactured. I remember being in Endicott and going through the facility that was building the memory components of the computer. And in those days, the memory components of the computer were little iron donuts to which you had to thread three wires. And those were done by hand. You had people in an assembly line with big magnifying glasses threading wires through small little donuts.
And this was high tech then. I mean, this is it. This was cutting edge technology.
That was the state of the art.
So your first client or one of your clients was J.C. Penney, and this meant that you were working on a secret product.
That's correct. This is how I got involved and ended up in North Carolina. At the time, I was the systems engineer for J.C. Penney. And just to give you a little bit of perspective, J.C. Penney in those days was bigger than IBM.
Wow.
So IBM was very interested in making sure that J.C. Penney's was a well taken care of customer and that all the resources of IBM were always available to them. So little did I know, but one day I had a visit at the office, the IBM office, of a group of people that come to New York from North Carolina, and the IBMers working in the RTP facility here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And they set me up in an office and told me that they were going to give me some information that was proprietary in nature and confidential. And they started to tell me about this big new development that they were doing here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And if you remember, those were the days where the scanner, UPC scanner, was being, shall we say, invented.
Yeah.
In,
I mean, we
North
take that
Carolina.
For granted, but I do come from a time when there was no such thing.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So it was punch in the price of the product.
So it was here in North Carolina where IBM was developing a point of sale system, which including scanning for supermarkets, of course. But they were interested in not only building the product, but actually finding out how people were going to use it. And what better pilot than JCPenney in those days, the largest retailer in the world. So they kind of, after swearing me to secrecy, offered me the opportunity to come down to Raleigh and become part of the project from the application development point of view. In other words, how was all this point-of-sale system going to be used? Little did I know that that implied leaving Monday mornings from New York and coming back to New York Friday nights. So for about 9 months, almost a little bit short of a year, that was my schedule.
Wow. Well, what did you think of North Carolina? Giving us an idea, when was this?
1972.
Yeah.
1972, North Carolina. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a dry state.
Oh, yeah, there was that.
Being from Cuba, Havana, and living in New York, I did not understand the concept of you cannot have a drink. But then when I found out about the brown bagging, that really blew my mind.
You not only can you not get a Cuban cigar, you can't get any rum, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, and in those days, Raleigh was a small little town,
yeah.
No question about it. I remember many a nights while I was working that there was no place to go eat but the hotel. Everything closed about 7, 8 o'clock at night. And if I was on a second shift, by the time I left, there was no choice. Everything was closed. So to me, it was a small little town coming from New York. But I had, the fortune of meeting a very good friend of mine, Horace Clements, who is my business partner ever since then. I remember being in the lab one day. This was over a weekend because we were doing some finalization of testing. And I had been told that if I ever got in trouble, I should call this number and somebody would come and help me out. So sure enough, I got in trouble, called the number, told him that I had a problem and I needed help. Said right away, I'll come over. And I was sitting there just doing some debugging of my programs. And all of a sudden, I see this guy coming in overalls and I look at him. And he says, "Are you Saul Barenthal? I came here to help you." I said, "Oh, my God. This is what's going to get me out of trouble? I'm in deeper trouble." But sure enough, Horace was in the farm doing his chores when I called, and he just came over to help. And ever since then, we established a great relationship. And to me, it was very helpful.
So he was a North Carolina farmer?
He is the Alabama farmer happened to have transferred also to North Carolina to work on the project.
Wow. So he knows his stuff when it comes to zeros and ones, but at his heart, he's a farmer, shows up in the overhauls and actually
Correct.
Fixes your problem.
That gives you an idea of where tractors come from.
We're going to get to that in the business you're going to open in Cuba together, because he did stay your business partner. I'm just also interested in this moment in history. JCPenney is larger than IBM, but you're developing this program that ultimately, if you think it through, is going to put JCPenney practically out of business, because one of the things the scanner, this point of sale system, does, it doesn't just speed up the checkout process, it becomes a marketing tool. Mm-hmm. And we can now take a look at your shopping practices and your habits and all of that, which is going to make it easier for JCPenney to market, but even easier for, say, Amazon to market.
Well, competition, of course. In those days, the competition of JCPenney was not the Amazon. The competition of JCPenney's was the Kmart's
sure.
and the Target's. To come, because
right.
in those days they were not even there. And then also you had the Walmarts.
Right. But I'm saying that this marketing revolution, this idea that we can now pull this information about shoppers together.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. The first, just to go back to the story, Horace and I finished up implementing the JCPenney project. And everything was good. I was back in New York doing my business, taking care of my customers. And one day they called me back from North Carolina and said, "You got to come down because we need your help." I said, "Well, I thought we were finished with this." He said, No. We are now inviting people from Europe to come to the U.S. to look at the product. And we have this company coming from Spain, and they don't speak any English. So since you speak Spanish, why don't you come down here and help us through the presentations and all that kind of stuff? Little did I know at the time that I was going to meet with El Corte Inglés. El Corte Inglés is one of the largest retailers in Europe. And El Corte Inglés has a very interesting connection. Why? Because at the same time that I was leaving Cuba, the family that owned El Encanto, which was the big department store in Cuba, was also leaving Cuba. And that family went to Spain because they were originally from Spain. And the guy that started El Corte Inglés was the son of the family about my age that when he went to Spain started his business and turned it into one of the major retailers. So once he learned that the guy in Raleigh, North Carolina that was doing the presentations to their people and actually was the one who did the implementation in JCPenney's, he told IBM that if IBM wanted to sell any IBM equipment to El Corte Inglés, it would have to be done by somebody in Raleigh who speaks the language that comes from Cuba, and they should go and do it. So that's how Horace and I spent 2 years in Madrid.
Oh, so you go to Spain as part of this project because of your, not only the Penny's connection, a big retailer, so that would have attracted, but clearly because you had both had a connection to Cuba. But you and Horace also recognized at a certain point that there were certain efficiencies that could have been created in this product, and IBM, because of the way it was structured, wasn't having any of it. Let's tell us that story.
Well, what happened was that once we were in Europe, and yeah, we did the implementation for El Corte Inglés, but we coordinated with all the other countries that were also working on point-of-sale systems for IBM, England, France, Italy. And one of the things that we learned in those days was how do retailers work in Europe, a little bit different from the U.S. So Horace and I did have the capability of understanding retail worldwide. And when it came the time that we finished the Corte Inglés implementation in 76 and came the time to start working on the second generation of point of sale, the guys in Raleigh asked us to come back. And when Horace and I said, well, now we're going to have the opportunity to do the second evolution of the product, we started talking about how we're going to do it. You know, how are we going to architect this thing to be better based on all the experience that we had both in the U.S. and Europe. And we concluded that then at the time, again, the personal computer was coming of age as a business tool. And Horace and I had the ability to go and visit with a rival lab of IBM in Boca Raton and look into under the covers of the then beginning of the personal computer. And we were convinced that the personal computer was going to be the heart of the new evolution to the next point of sale generation. So when we came back to Raleigh, we said, okay, this is our plan and this is what we're going to implement. And the people in Research Triangle Park said, not so fast.
We don't do that here.
That product is not our product, and therefore we're not going to be basing it on that architecture. So Horace and I said, okay, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do. And we worked for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, in getting the second generation in place, at which time we said to ourselves, okay, so we did it because that's the way they wanted us to do it. We know that there is a better way. Looks like an opportunity. So we decided to quit IBM and form our own company. And it's interesting that at the time, it was not an easy thing to leave a company like IBM and go on your own. It's not like today's environment. But we were so convinced that we were right that we did it. We talked to our boss, and our boss said, okay, if you guys want to do this, let's do it right. Go out there, do your thing, but do remember, if you ever want to come back, your jobs will be here waiting for you. Don't worry about that. But on the other hand, make sure that when you do what you do, you do it for the benefit of IBM.
Wonder what that means, because you're your own company, right?
Yeah, but we were basing all of our products on supporting IBM equipment.
I get it. So it might be, there you go. Saul Barenthal, well, we'll find out how that turned out and how that turned into the tractor business, ultimately. The first American factory since the embargo in Cuba since 1960. Saul Barenthal is the co-owner of that company, and we'll find out what he plans to do when our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Saul Barenthal today. Co-owns a business that plans to bring tractors to small farms in Cuba, and that will be the first U.S. factory in Cuba since the 1960 embargo. So you talked about the fact that you and Horace Clemens you've started a business together. You figured out that PC is the future. This is sometime in the early 80s, I assume. And you develop a successful business.
Yeah. In terms of the business, it was our first venture. We put together three different ventures that we actually did. And you spoke a little bit earlier about the significance of the scanner and capturing information. Our first business that we sold or spun off was to Citicorp. In those days, Citicorp was interested in learning about purchasing habits. And since we had a point-of-sale system that scanned and knew what people were purchasing, they came to us, worked with us in developing a system that they were going to use to do exactly that, capture information. And after we got it all developed and implemented for the supermarket industry, they made us an offer we couldn't refuse. So we spun off our first supermarket division and sold it to Citicorp for them to start getting into that business.
So you're doing pretty well. Tell us about this developments in Cuba. It didn't happen overnight, and it didn't start with the president's announcement, did it?
Well, 2007, I started traveling to Cuba. I had already sold the three ventures that we had started, had a little bit of time in my hands, and I thought to myself, why not go find out what's going on? So I started traveling mainly to show the kids where I came from, and to meet some people. I had the fortune of meeting a few people that were involved, academics that were involved in the development of the then new economic system that Cuba was putting in place. It was about in the late 2009, 2010 that Fidel Castro was interviewed and was asked a question about would he still be pushing for socialism in Latin America? And his answer was, why would I do that? Because it doesn't even work in Cuba anymore. So it was in those days that the Cuban people had already realized that there had to be some economic changes. So they had a bunch of people in the University of Havana, in the economic department, working on what that new framework would be. I got to meet some of them, and I got a little bit of insight as to what it was that they were planning. I started doing some exchanges of academics between U.S. universities and University of Havana.
Were they calling you in as a kind of consultant on this process, this change
process? No, more than anything else, just as a person that was able to introduce people from one university to the other and go through all the logistics of how do you travel to Cuba in those days, how do you get visas, permits, licenses, all that kind of stuff. I had pretty good acquaintances at the then Cuban interest section.
Had you been back to Cuba before
this? Yes. So okay. I had met some people. I had learned a lot of things, and I always thought, and I told Horace, that one day there would be an opportunity for us to do something in Cuba. And I thought it would be in the software development area. But it was not to be done that way. In 2014, President Obama decides to change U.S. policy towards Cuba. And he does it in three main areas. He does it in the areas of agriculture, construction, and communications. So I told Horace, looks like this is the time. What can we do within these constraints? And he says, well, let's go find out what's going on in Cuban agriculture. So we go spend some time talking to people at the university level as well as in the countryside itself as to what were the problems in Cuba.
This gives Horace a chance to put his overalls back.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that we start learning that the model of the Cuban agriculture is not what it used to be when I lived there. It was not the big American companies or the big Cuban companies with large-scale agriculture. On the contrary, 70% of agriculture in Cuba is done by small farms. The government on purpose has distributed the land in sizes of anywhere between 15 to 60 hectares. A hectare is about 2-point-something acres. Mm. So it's very much like the family farm used to be in the States in the 1940s, 1950s. And once we learn that, Horace says, well, he remembers when he used to be a farmer with his grandparents, and he remembers a model of a Alice Chandler tractor, which was actually built in Alabama, that was very, very easy to build, easy to work with, and easy to maintain and service. And he said, this is an ideal model for what's going on in Cuba right now. So the idea came up with, why don't we go and propose to the Cuban people something like this? Not using the old Alice Chandler, but using the model, but upgrading it to state-of-the-art technologies. And they saw that with a very good impression on them, and they said, if you build it, you can bring it.
Now, initially, I understand, though, there was some resistance, some sense initially that you were bringing them an old American tractor.
When we told them, and we were honest with them, we told them, we're going to base it on this Alice Chandler 1940s, 1950s model. They say, well, what are you trying to do? Yeah. You're trying to bring something that is no longer applicable to the U.S., and you're going to dump it here in Cuba? We spent a lot of time explaining to them that it was just the model of it, not the insides of it. And we actually took it to a couple of fairs in Cuba so that we could show it and have people actually analyze and understand the technology. And they were very impressed. They had never seen a tractor that is driven by hydraulics, which is what we are implementing into the tractor right now.
In fact, you had I think one reaction in particular heartened you, what one individual said when they saw it.
Well, there's two things that really stayed in our minds as we were talking to people and they were making comments. One of them was the fact that one of them came over to us and said, you know, you are bringing here something for the forgotten people. The small agriculture family in Cuba is the forgotten people. The government does not provide them with anything. They have to work the land with livestock. It is very difficult for them to be productive and not have the tools to do it with. So he referred to the forgotten people as to those people that the government is not really doing much for, and that if we come, if we can come with a tool that will increase their productivity, these people can prosper.
If they can afford it. What's going to
be the... Well, the affordability of it has to do with the financing of it. Mm. So putting in place the proper financing vehicles, we can make that happen. We've already talked to the Cuban government in terms of their ability to be a distributor, financer of the tractor. And within our regulations here in the States, as long as the end product ends at in the hands of the private sector, the agriculture person themselves, it's not a problem.
So even now you could do that? Is that
you can do that, but yeah, even more important than that, remittances to Cuba. The Cuban-American population in the U.S. remits about over $2 billion a year. Many of them have friends, families, and even themselves own farms in Cuba. And they would be more than willing to finance those tractors here in the U.S. to be delivered in Cuba.
So what if any, impact does all of this change have? And if the embargo is lifted, does that change much for you?
Well, it will change a lot. It'll make things much easier. as it is right now, it's very difficult because of some of the remaining of the embargo. So once the embargo is lifted, things will become much easier, especially in financing and being able to ship and produce and all those type of things. But the more important thing about what's going on right now is the fact that Cuba today imports between 70 and 80% of what it eats, meaning that they're not productive enough to be able to feed the population. And remember, feeding of the population is one of the logros of the revolution. The government is committed to subsidize food for their people. So they never have enough food. You add to that the fact that tourism is increasing in Cuba tremendously. Last year they had for the first time they went a little bit over 3 million tourists in Cuba. They're forecasting 6 million people in Cuba within the next 5 years. If they do not become productive enough, there will not be enough food to feed the tourism that is going to come to Cuba. So that is one of the impetus of why they're so interested on a productivity tool like the one we're delivering to them.
I wonder what's the long-term hope for this product, because as you move to a more market-based framework, invite foreign capital and allow it to work through markets on a freer basis, it also changes the dynamics, and these small farms might not be small farms. We might get industrial agriculture like we have it here.
Large-scale agriculture will never happen in Cuba.
Why not?
It is a commitment of the government to make sure that the land is never accumulated in the same fashion that it was before the revolution.
So it's interesting, as they've thought about this, you say the thought process began several years ago on how to change this framework. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Cubans have managed to maintain, maybe no great shakes in human rights, although I don't know how the U.S. compares necessarily. Well, that's a discussion for another time, but certainly not in the free speech is not anything that they can brag about in Cuba. But on the other hand, medical care, life expectancy longer than the United States, sort of infant mortality better than the United States. There's a lot of things that work really well in Cuba.
Education.
More and more people have at least a basic education there. It seems as though they're trying to maybe protect themselves against some of the worst excesses in the American capitalist system, which is now producing some very bad fruit here.
Yeah, there's no question about it that they do understand what can become of it, and that they have put in place a framework that will make sure that that does not happen. Mm-hmm. One never can tell what's going to happen 20, 30 years from now, but in the immediate future, there is no appetite for any large scale anything. For example, major companies, what you would call international companies, right, global companies, can only invest in Cuba by becoming a partner with the Cuban government, where the Cuban government has the majority controlling interest on it. So major companies, global companies, will never be able to have the impact that they have when they come to a country. They tend to dominate their segment of the economy. Cuba is very much aware of that and will not allow it. So even though they will accept global companies' investments, it's always going to be with that. On the other hand, small companies like ours, they will allow to have 100% ownership. We are a 100% American-owned company, but we are small enough that they can control.
An interesting feature of your tractors, too, is that you're working on an open-source model so that people can. So tell us how that's going to work.
Well, this is one of the aspects of our project that mostly interested the Cuban government. They realized that what we were doing is not only building a tractor, but building a manufacturing base, a manufacturing architecture for many other things. In our plans, in conjunction with them, is the ability to not only build tractors, but also build light construction equipment that will be based on the same architecture with the same hydraulics and everything else. Therefore, creating for Cuba an industrial base that not only it's going to be for their benefit, but also for export to the rest of Latin America. one of the things that we look at about the investment that we're making in Mariel, which is the big development zone, is the fact that Cuba has very, very good commercial treaties with the rest of Latin America, which allows anything that we build in Cuba, hecho in Cuba, land much cheaper in any of those countries than if the same product was built here in the States and exported.
Wow. So that gives them a real advantage once they get that industry up and going. And because you don't have a proprietary relationship with the parts makers, independent Cuban businesses can go make parts for your tractors, correct, and this becomes a much broader-based industry.
Correct. We modeled that after our software experience. We also build, if you remember, why did we pick the personal computer as the basis? We wanted an open source, an open systems environment. So the same concepts that we used when we developed our business from a software perspective, we're using when we're developing our business from a manufacturing perspective. The ability to get off-the-shelf components from multiple vendors is not only economically good, but from the psyche of the Cuban people is very advantageous because they've had the experience of an embargo that does not allow them to buy parts from certain sources.
Right. Well, so where are you in the process, and do you have to sweat out this upcoming presidential election?
Oh, yeah? Yes, very much so, very much so. The process in Cuba is very bureaucratic. There's no question about it. But I guess we're used to it. We spent 8.5 months waiting for the bureaucracy in the States to give us the permits. So we are now into the first 60 days of going through the process in Cuba. It'll probably take another few months, and they will probably push it until after the election cycle.
Well, Saul, thank you so much. What a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Saul Barenthal co-owns a business called Kleber LLC. It plans to bring tractors to small farms in Cuba, and as we've said, the first U.S. factory in Cuba since the 1960 embargo. State of Things going to Greensboro tomorrow, and you can be there in our live audience at the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. We've got all the details if you want to join us for some live music there as well, as we pay tribute to Sister Rosetta Tharpe, among other things, tomorrow in Greensboro. RSVP at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.